everyone, welcome along to episode 92 of Percussion Discussion. Please check out our social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and our world-famous YouTube channel, where you can find all conversations past and present. If you can find 2 seconds to subscribe, this really helps, and it means also that you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes, of which there's some really, really good ones, so we don't want you to miss those. If you'd rather listen on the go, this is no problem. All of our conversations are available in podcast form, so they're free to download from all of your usual podcast providers, so no problems there. Now, if you can find just a couple of seconds, if you can just give us a rating, give us a like, a share, a review, all really, really helps. On to today's guest, a fabulous guy and a very, very funny guy too. Since the early 90s, he's been playing with Dodgy, who are still going, still releasing albums and still gigging. They've given us some fantastic songs over the years. As well as Dodgy, he's played for the likes of the Lightning Seeds, Ian McNabb and the Icicle Works, and many, many more. It gives me great pleasure to welcome the fabulous Mr. Math Priest. Math, thanks so much for doing this, mate. It's really kind of you.
Pleasure.
It's good to see you. So are you keeping well?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I work during the day as well. I teach kids with emotional behavioural difficulties.
Amazing.
Teach them a bit of drums, teach maths as well, bizarrely.
Wow.
Weird.
Okay.
Well, there's a big link between, certainly on the level that I teach it, which is not necessarily high,
yeah,
there's a big link between maths and drumming, you know, yeah, certainly when you're doing fractions and sequences and things like that, you know. Cool. And I've been doing that for a while. But I think I might be moving on to pastures new. You know, I've heard Liam and John Squire are forming a super group, and they're going to need a super drummer.
Hey.
Hey.
That sounds good. Hey.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I might be moving on doing different things. So.
Oh, excellent stuff. That's good. Yeah, well, as you say, with the maths thing, it is a you know, subdivisions of, you know, I'm all right up to 32 and downwards. Over that, I'm struggling a little bit, I'll be honest. But
if you teach it the American way, you know, half notes, quarter notes, eighth notes, 16th notes, and you don't do, you know, the crotchets, you know, semiquavers, demi-semiquavers, whatever. But if you do it simply what it is, quarter notes, eighth notes, then you can teach fractions alongside drumming, you know, and it's... And it's great. Certainly, if you've got a sort of three or four kids in the class, you can do one doing quarter notes, one doing eighth notes, you know, and it's and they start to understand about fractions. Yeah,
that's pretty amazing, really, isn't it? You know, and you get, you know, you bring the drums in as well, and let's be honest, who doesn't like hitting drums?
This is it. Yeah. Well, what I found is because I've been doing it about 8 years, what I found is that drumming is a fantastic tool for teaching kids with, you know, kids who've got trauma, attachment issues, kids who've had a problem accessing mainstream, because the rewards are quite instant with drums. You know, it's not like playing a guitar. I mean, fuck, you know, I still have issues. You know, I mean, I've got drummer fingers, look. You know, and it's hard, and you've got to work at it, which is fair enough, and that's why guitarists are so fucking arrogant. but with drums, it's quite instant, you know. If a kid's got a little bit of sense or intelligence about them, they can knock up that basic beat within half an hour, 40 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them 5 minutes, some of them a couple of minutes, you know. But they can knock up that basic beat, and so bang, they've achieved something really quickly. And for kids who've got emotional behavioural difficulties, to achieve something quickly is great. And then you can then say to them, look, why did you achieve that? And why did you achieve it so quickly? I'll tell you why. Because you listened to me.
Yes.
You listened to me, and you practiced, and you slowed down. And those are the kind of skills that they can then take into other lessons, like maths or English and stuff, of just listening, slowing down, not giving up. All those things you can learning a real basic rhythm in drumming, and then perhaps go and learning geography or whatever, you know. So it's great. It's a really good learning tool, you know.
And I have to ask, are these kids aware of your background and your musical history? Are they aware of any of it, or
the other teachers tell them, you know, and you know, it's a thing, and you know, eventually they'll find me on YouTube, yeah, swearing and doing Glastonbury or whatever, and oh wow, out. And, you know, some kids are impressed, other kids aren't, you know. It's music is a whole different, has a whole different cultural importance to what it did, even in the 90s, you know.
Massively.
Music kind of is something that accompanies TikTok nowadays and not necessarily something that could change your life.
Yeah, I teach a lot of drums as well. And if you ask any kid of, I don't know, between, I don't know, from like 5 years old up to 12, what's your favorite song? What's your favorite band? I don't know. They don't have one. They can't name a song that, or a favorite band. When I was that age, I got 5 pages of A4. Yeah, I worked your way through it, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, absolutely, because what could you spend your money on? You could spend your money on albums.
Yeah, it's true.
Spend your money on, I mean, there's not a lot else you can spend your money on in the 80s and 90s, you know, on records, you know, and then of course it all changed, and the cultural importance of music did really change, you know, and you know, it's progress, you know. I really, really try not to sound like my granddad, you know. Oh, bloody music. It's not the same like I was when I was a kid. He's not from Leeds, by the way. I don't know why I put that accent on. But you know what I mean? It's different. It's completely different to when I was in the music industry, you know, successful in the music industry, and when I was a kid. You know, it is. But wow, what access. It's huge access to music that they've got now than I could never have, you know?
There's no excuse anymore, is there? Let's be honest.
Exactly.
Apart from it's maybe too easy, and it's do we need to do it? It's that easy? Yeah, I don't know, but hey. Anyways, look, let's go back a little while, a couple of years, to where kind of music caught fire for you, if you like. Matt, forget drums. You know, what's your kind of first memories of music itself?
I was lucky because my dad was really into music. He had a big vinyl collection, and he loved all sorts, bizarrely. You know, he loved his Sly and the Family Stone. He loved his Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and he loved soul. He loved Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett. He had the original Otis Blue, but he also loved stuff like Charles Aznavour and Johnny Mathis and Nelly Lucia and Nina Simone. He loved everything, and he loved the Clancy Brothers and the Dubliners, and a real Catholic music taste, as in just really broad. And then later on in his life, he started to really get into jazz. And he just loved music. You know, he loved Indian music. Whatever he heard, he would always find something. So I was lucky in the sense that I had access to his record collection and whatnot. And my brother, similarly, who's 2.5 years older than me, he similarly got into music and was obsessed with music. He collected every single 7-inch by The Jam.
Oh, cool.
An album by The Jam. But then also, bizarrely, Bauhaus and Japan.
Oh, blimey, okay.
I know, but also loads of Northern Soul stuff. And, you know, he just had a real, again, he just loved music. And so I had this real massive, broad sort of introduction to music. There was always a bit of music going on in the house, and I didn't even know that I could buy it myself just because I just listened to their music all the time. So I was lucky in that sense. There was always music going on, and my dad took me to go and see Queen. My first ever concert when I was 10, which was on the Flash Tour at the NAC in Birmingham. And they still had the Queen Life Killers stage show with the drum riser with the white lights underneath it and stuff. And Freddie was still in the biker gear. And so, that was my first gig. And my dad thought it important that we go and see him. We still have Queen and sing Queen around the house. So I was very lucky in that sense, you know. And I'm pretty sure if I didn't have my dad and my older brother, then I wouldn't have been obsessed with music like I am, you know.
Absolutely. Well, my first gig was Judas Priest, believe it or not, at the age of 11.
It's breaking the law.
You got it. Yeah. But, but I mean, seeing Queen at that age, I mean, it is, was, whichever way you look at it, is Roger Taylor an influence on you? Because you can't help but be, seeing something like that, can you?
Yeah, you know what? I loved his flexibility. And to me, he's quite a bit like Ringo in that sense.
Yeah.
Is that you can, he can play a song like Summer 69, 59, Summer 69's Brian Adams. in the year of, you know, the Brian May song, I think there's some tribe drums on there. Oh, yeah. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but say Crazy Little Thing Called Love, or like Seven Seas of Rye, or like Killer Queen with that really lovely shuffle groove on there. There was no defining sound to Roger Taylor. You know what I mean? Obviously, he loved the Tom Toms when he got going, and because he was a massive fan of Mooney, like I am, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But what I loved about him is that there was really no style to him, if you know what I mean. And I think that's probably why he gets overlooked a lot, because he does get overlooked quite a bit. Ringo was in the Beatles, and they're the biggest band in the world and the greatest band in the world, arguably. And so he always gets mentioned. And also those little tasteful fills he did are amazing. Charlie Watts gets mentioned a lot because his style was like no one else's. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so, you know, when Bonham, obviously Bonham and obviously Mooney, but Roger Taylor kind of doesn't get mentioned that often. And I think it's because he was so, he adapted to the song, which is what I always did, what I've always done, you know. And, you know, if it doesn't require a big beat, if it requires something really gentle, something soft there, then I'll do that, you know. And it's you play the song, you don't play the drums, you know.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. You know, you said exactly the right thing. That's what it should be about. You know, that's what it was about with all the drummers you've just mentioned.
Well, not Bonham.
No,
Bonham played Bonham, and because he was so unique, and that's the difference. Bonham, yeah, he would play soft, but it was still Bonham. Mooney played whatever, but it was still Mooney.
Oh yeah.
Well, what I'm saying there, they were so unique in their styles that you knew it was them playing. But you could hear you could hear a Queen song and strip away the guitar, because again, the guitar and the vocals are so unique within Queen.
Yeah.
But the pattern he was playing or the way he played it, you would not necessarily know, oh, that's Roger Taylor. Sure. Because he was just so brilliant at being adaptable to it. And I think that's what gets overlooked with him.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think Brighton Rock is one of the first things I ever heard. And that's just stunning, isn't it? You know, out and out stunning. But so anyway, obviously, we kind of got a bit off track here talking about the genius.
Well, we're talking about drums, Matty. Yeah.
No, but what I'm saying is, where did drums come into it for you, Math? Where did they kind of pick up?
Well, I was asked this the other day, and I think because me auntie, because I'm from the Black Country, and my dad's mom had six sisters, and we used to go to the Black Country night out, which was like a thing at some kind of concert hall or some kind of hall. I'm sure one of your listeners will know, near Dudley or Tipton or or Stourbridge or something. And they'd always have a comedian on, Tommy Munden, who was, how you doing? Oh, all right, you doing? And he'd be telling, making all the old ladies laugh. And they'd always have a band on, they'd always have a turn. And the band would be, you know, in the front of the stage. And I'd just always just go up and just look at the drummer because, I mean, they were just doing standards. But I was amazed with the look of it, the aesthetics of it. I was amazed with this hi-hat that did this. And it was his left foot that did that. And this and the big shiny cymbals and this, the drum, everything had a different sound. And I don't know, maybe because I love Lego or I love... It was as a toy, when you're young, it's mind-blowing. You go, wow, you can do this and do that. And it's, you know, other kids got into cars because... You know, your left foot does that, your right foot, you've got a steering wheel. But I just looked at that and I thought, that looks amazing. So, you know, mum and dad bought me a snare drum when I was nine, just a snare drum. But they didn't give me like a Buddy Rich book of, rudiments.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't do that. I was just playing Shawaddy Waddy. I don't know what I was doing, you know what I mean? And, of course, I lost a bit of, you know, interest. I'm like, fucking snare drum, but I kept putting drum kit on the Christmas list.
Yeah.
Santa, bless him, finally got me a drum kit when I was 13, and it was an old secondhand Mapex mixed up with Pearl, mixed up with something else, and you know, it probably would have, you know, You look at eBay now, it would probably cost about 100 quid, 150 quid. But it was my kit, and it was white.
Yeah, that's what it
was. And, you know, a couple of symbols. And I think Mom was hoping maybe that the interest would wane. But I set it up, and I played it every single day, you know, and I just played along to songs and taught myself, essentially. Badly, because I picked up loads of bad habits when you teach yourself, you know. You know, I didn't know what a single stroke was, single stroke roll or double stroke roll, or I didn't know any of the rudiments. I just knew that, you know, that was a great beat to play. And, yeah, and the more I got into music, the more I got into bands like Jimi Hendrix, or I got into different styles. I'd go, well, how does he play that then? All right. So I have to learn, you know, and, you know, as I remember specifically when Nigel, you know, I first met Nigel, who we went on to form Dodgy with, and that's what I was like, 17, 16. And he says, can you sort of do a beat like this, which is, you know, kind of like which is like a Jimi Hendrix Mitch Mitchell beat.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, that'd be great if we could have this in this song. And I'm like, fuck, I don't know how to play that. So, of course, I learned it. And so it was learning on the job, you know what I mean? Totally that. It wasn't like a drum teacher had come in and said, well, this is how you play the funky beat, and this is level three, this is level four, and this is the kind of, and you've got to do this, you've got to put the skip in. And then I applied what I'd learned to the songs. It was like the song demanded this of me, so I had to learn how to play it, you know? And that was a really good way of learning, you know? Me and Nigel learned on the job together, you know?
That gives you your slight own footprint, doesn't it? You know, in some respects.
Oh, totally.
Play the way you play, and hey, and let's be honest, there was enough success had with it, wasn't there?
Well, this is it. You know, when Dodgy had become successful, and, you know, we'd had million records worldwide, and we'd had, you know, really great albums and whatnot, and toured around the world, I was always aware that I was blagging it a bit, you know. I was kind of, I was getting away with it, you know what I mean? I was not a trained drummer, you know, and I knew my left hand was fucking lazy and it wasn't as quick as my right hand. And I thought, well, let's go and see if I can just get a little bit better at playing the drums. So just off my own back, I just thought, I'll go and do it. I said, I blagged it really well. You know, I did really well at blagging it. And I went to see this guy, Joel Rothman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
An old jazzer from New York. And he lived in Highgate in London. I went to see him and...
still around?
Is he still around? Yeah, great. Great. I'm glad he hasn't died. A real character. And I told him the story, you know, band Dodgy, and we've done really well, sold over a million records worldwide, toured around the world, and released three albums. He goes, oh, great, great, man, I'm good, good, let me just see what you got. Play me a double stroke roll. I'm like, oh. So I just did a crush roll, you know, you know, because that's what I got away with.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, do me a double stroke roll, you know, start slow and then build it up. And I'm like, he goes, you can't do a double stroke roll? What the fuck? And he goes, are you successful? How the fuck are you successful? What? You can't play a double stroke roll? How the fuck have you made money? And he was brilliant, because I was like, exactly, mate. You know, what you can do for that, you can play punk originally for that, or rock and roll originally. But then again, of course, all the drummers were brilliant in rock and roll, and all the drummers were brilliant in punk. Yeah. But then indie music in the 90s took the really ethos of punk, which is you don't need to be able to play. You just need to be able to get across and be in a band. And that's what I was on the hangover of, which is you can just get in a band and play and just be. You don't have to reach a certain standard. You don't have to be as good as Bill Bruford.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That's what Paul Cook, the ethos of punk. You don't have to be as good as Phil Collins. You don't have to be as good as these drummers in prog rock bands, you know. You can just go in and play. And so that whole ethos of we can play, it's our music as well. We can do whatever we want. So that certainly seeped into the whole indie ethos, which is where I was coming through from. But as a jazzer from New York, he lived and breathed by how good he was. And he couldn't understand why I couldn't play a double stroke. I got on with him really well. I loved him. Because I was just like, fair enough, man. I'll learn. You show me what I'll do. And, you know, and he showed me a bit. And then I went on tour again and didn't keep it up, you know.
But you know, isn't it nice the fact that you've kind of recognized the fact that maybe you have a, you know, certain weaknesses playing, and you've you know, humble enough to do it. That's good.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when I teach, because I teach, and I'm saying to kids, look, man, you know, you're going to be better than me soon. You've got to be better than me. You've got to try to be that. You know, because what they're getting is what I didn't have, which is a drum teacher. You know, and teaching them how to warm up. You know, and teaching them how to get their left hand as strong as the right hand, and teach them how to read. You know what I mean? The only way I learned how to read, really, is by teaching kids. You know what I mean? It's John Rothman sort of showed me a little bit of, you know, reading rhythm and whatnot and how to do that. So I always obviously had a big idea of how to do it. But there's nothing like that. There's nothing that teaches you how to learn something than teaching someone else.
Yeah,
you
know? I agree. Totally agree. I really do. I mean, you know, I've always really liked your drumming style. From whenever I've heard Dodgy albums, it's always sounded really organic, nice sounds, nothing overcomplicated, just playing the song, basically. But it's always fitted, and it always sounds, you know, it almost makes a mockery of what you've just said, because it sounds so natural and nice, you know. But it makes a mockery, but equally, it you're kind of backing up what you've said as well, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, because you don't need to play. I mean, that's the thing with a lot of the, you know, phenomenal drummers that you see on clinics and on YouTube and whatnot. When they're actually playing in songs, they don't get to utilize any of that stuff. It's just for clinics, or it's just for YouTube. And that was it. And so you know, I love it, and it's always bringing in different sound, not sounds, but different. I mean, you know, the era that I was always obsessed with, that I loved, was the late 60s and the sound of those guys, you know, the Mooney, Bonham, but also Mick Fleetwood, Kenny Jones, you know, Mitch Mitchell, the sound that they got and the swing that they had. You know, and then in the 90s, the only guy that was doing that was Rennie from the Stone Roses, you know, and he had that as well. And the thing is with me, it was like, what the other music I love was Motown and Northern Soul. So I'd be bringing that in, you know, and you'd see that Rennie would be doing that, and you'd say, oh, I see what he's doing there, you know. And I think that's what it is. That's where the innovation comes from, is being able to bring a beat in that you've heard on a record that's not necessarily from that genre, and going, that's what Bonham did so brilliantly. You know, Bonham was a massive fan of funk and Motown, you know, and that's why he was so good, you know. And that's why a lot of rock drummers after him are so crap, because they're fans of Bonham, not fans of Motown. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it was the fact that he had that Motown and jazz and soul love that made him swing like a fucking set of rhinoceroses knocking bollocks. You know what I mean? It was like, he was amazing.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, you know, you mentioned you love the 60s sounds on the Homegrown album. Excuse me. I think that's a great 60s sort of sound you've got. It just sounds, even down to the reverbs on it, it's like classic. The drums sound old. I don't know if it was vintage stuff you recorded on, but they sound, how do I put it? They sound 60s, you know. I don't know how else to describe it.
Absolutely. Well, Hugh Jones, who's been around for ages, you know, let's see, I think he was 70 the other day.
Oh, right.
Bless him. But he recorded so many bands, you know. He recorded with the Damned and Status Quo and Thin Lizzy in the 70s and the Icicle Works. He's been through so many stages of music and seen all this new technology come in. So he knew the sound I wanted, you know. He knew that I didn't want the big booming 80s sound with that Chris Sharrock got on Icicle Works. I wanted it natural. I wanted it kind of sort of dryish, you know what I mean? And he knew what I wanted. He knew the style I was playing, with the swing, with that late 60s swing. There was a great story I was just going to say then. You said about the, sorry, mate, the last question you said, you mentioned something and it really triggered something in my head. I was going to tell you something.
I remember.
Never mind.
Was it about the reverb on the toms and stuff? I said, was it not that?
No, what was it you were saying about the sound or something? That's it. You'll like this. 1991, we got our first big check from our record company. We got signed by A&M and BMG Publishing. Got that check. And so we got sent off to buy our equipment, you know, because I had a shitty Pearl Export at the time, and with these big tom-toms, you know. And I wanted a kit that sounded old, you know what I mean? Ringo's kit, Bono's kit, Communis kit, Mick Fleetwood. I really love Mick Fleetwood sound, you know, with the Peter Green Fleetwood Mac, you know. And so I went into the, what was it called in Golden Square? And it was the big percussion, big massive drum store in London. And it'll come to me, Goots or Golds or something. Your listeners will know exactly what I mean. It was a massive drum store on Golden Square, just by Piccadilly, in London. And I went in there, and it was huge. You go in there, there's drums everywhere. And I went up to the counter, and I said to the kid behind the counter, I said, I said, what are you after? I said, well, I want an old sounding kit. He goes, right, okay. He goes, well, you know, we've got these new IOTI kits in that are really nice, and they're made of certain woods and stuff. So, right, I said, I looked at him, I was like, I also wanted the look of it, you know what I mean? I wanted to look old. And it's coming to me, something Golden Square, the big percussion, it'll come to me. You watch. Anyway, and the kid behind the counter said, well, my brother's selling a really old kit. If you're interested, which is obviously against what the I hope he gets the ice cream on time. He's not going to sell ice creams at that speed. But he said, my brother's selling a drum kit that's really old. And I went, oh, okay. And I'm thinking, well, they're not going to want him to do an outside sale. I went, oh, we'll give him the number then. And his brother was Steve White.
So that was Alan.
So that was Alan.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was Alan. So I called Steve White up and I said, all right, mate, how you doing? And blah, blah, blah. And I went round to his house in Lewisham and I spent the afternoon with Steve White. Of course, I was a big fan because of the Style Council stuff. I loved Café Bleu.
Yeah.
The first cafe. And I loved his story of how he got in the band. He was 18 years old and he wrote to Weller and said, blah, blah. And Weller was looking for a jazz drummer and he was a jazz drummer, blah, blah, blah. And I loved that. But also, you know, who was White, one of his favourite drummers at the time, besides the jazz guys, it was Mooney.
Yeah,
and so we talked about Mooney for like 2 or 3 hours. And then he says, I suppose you want to see the kit in, do you? And it was a Blue Sparkle Gretsch.
Oh.
With two rack, two floor, and a bass drum, and they were from different eras.
Right,
I think the oldest drum was the 14-inch floor, which dated back to 1957, and then the 16-inch floor was added a bit later because it had different legs.
Yeah.
But what was lovely is the 12 and the 13 rack. There was no actual, look at that, that's a bit sexual, isn't it? There was no thing, it was actually on a rim. There was no holes in the drum.
Yeah.
And so I had that, and the bass drum was 22-inch, but it was pre-international.
Oh, yeah.
So 22-inch bass drum skins, you had to use butter or olive oil to kind of pop it on. It didn't quite fit.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was Blue Sparkle and it was Gretsch, round badge. And he gave me the old bollocks of like, oh mate, yeah, Japan, this will go up in value, and you know what I mean, you sell it there. And I think I bought it for $2,000 or something from him.
Oh, it'd be worth more than that now.
Do you reckon? Well, I've still got it.
Yeah.
So that's probably what I recorded a lot of homegrown on. Wow. Is that old round badge Gretsch kit.
Do you know what? I was going to ask if it was a Gretsch, because the tom sound is pretty... I find the Gretsch tom sound is pretty unique. And I was going to ask. I thought, no, it won't be. But I'm sorry, I didn't know.
There you go. Well, there's a story. There you go. And I've stayed in touch with Steve ever since. Well, of course, Weller, you know, blew up again in the 90s and Dodgy at the same time. So we bump into each other. And Steve's such a lovely bloke, very respectful again.
Yeah.
Very, no ego there whatsoever. And he's always been lovely with me. He really has. He's, you know, he's not like what you think in a way. You'd think they'd be like, oh, I've got fucking time for you, mate, or whatever. But he's always got time. He's always got time.
He's a lovely fella. Do you know what? I'm very lucky. Steve's done a couple of co-hosts on here with me. I know Steve's a big Slade fan, so we did we did two episodes with Don Powell.
Brilliant!
And it was awesome. It really was. So
brilliant! Did you hear that story? Because I got to meet Noddy Holder,
right?
And when I met him, because I speak so bad, still do. Hey, all right, mate. And all I need to do is listen to someone speak Black Country for literally 10 seconds, and I'm back there again. All right. And so I was there, and Noddy was like, oh, mate, great accent there. And so I was like, straight away, talking back to him, all right, mate. And he says, oh, great, let's go out for the meal. Let's go out for the meal. And let's have a bit of scram. And I went out with him, and him and his missus, and he looked after me and brought me, and I got a bit drunk, and we had. And he was lovely, and he told me stories about Slade on the road and Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, amazing.
But he told me about Don Powell, and he said, he was in a motorbike accident.
Yeah.
He lost his sense of smell and taste. He goes, he should have seen some of the bloody girls he brought back.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, Noddy, if you didn't want me to tell that story. But it's a bit late now. Sorry, mate.
Now, isn't it?
I'm just going to go to the fridge there. You'll see that I've got no trousers on, but that's a little treat for all the
spectacular
all the young drummers.
Thanks, Matt. Dear me.
Sorry, Matty.
Well, it is a warm night, to be fair, so,
it really
know.
Is. It really is. I'm going to stick this fella behind me as well. He's a mate of mine. He's a bit of a Star Wars geek. And he bought that, an R2-D2, on eBay a couple of weeks ago, but it was in Salisbury, which is where I live.
All right, okay.
And the guy lives in Salisbury. He goes, you see what if you drop him down to your house? I'm like, all right. So I've had him in my house for like a couple of weeks now. I put him up against the window. Three people out in the street below.
Oh, lovely. What more can you say? But do you know, I am so glad that, because I don't really write questions. I write bullet points. And by Homegrown, I've got massive 60s drums. That's what I've got. Great snare sounds on stuff. Oh, God. Crossroads, I think, is the big, nice big reverbs on there.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, we're also getting into the Beach Boys. You know, I remember me and Nige, we just kind of music together, and same with Andy as well.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it. Back then, now, we'd have access to everything, all types of music everywhere, and we'd satisfy our desire within 2 weeks. Yeah. But, you know, we'd find out. The only way we'd find out about the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds was because he's not with us anymore, bless him. Deli for Deli, who was a great writer for the NME, it was being re-released. And so he did a review of the re-release of Pet Sounds, and just gave it this review that, again, music journalism. When a music journalist makes you want to buy an album.
That's something, isn't it?
You know, and so I went, fuck, I've got to get that, you know. And so I bought Pet Sounds, and me and Nige got stoned and listened to Pet Sounds back in God knows what, 1990, and changed our lives forever, you know, listening to Pet Sounds. And I think that was definitely Nige, Crossroads, definitely channeling the Beach Boys. Yeah.
It's a beautiful song, though. It really is. I like it. It's lovely. And do you know, there's so many influences that you can hear in your music, and none of them are 90s things, are they? Let's be honest. You know, put together, it works as a 90s thing.
Well, we were into the rave thing because we, you know, it was a perfect period for us, you know, 80s, early 90s. we certainly got involved in that. And so, yeah, we loved all that. We loved Primal Scream and Future Sound of London. A lot of those sounds, you certainly hear those sounds coming in on the third album, 3PS Week. And a lot of hip-hop as well, you know, a lot of trip-hop as well, a lot of Tricky, Massive Attack. And so a lot of that stuff. The rock stuff, no. We weren't necessarily into that, apart from perhaps the Stone Roses and that. But other Britpop bands and other guitar bands in the 90s, we didn't listen to because we were still listening to the bands that those bands were
into. Yeah, yeah. And it gave you a very unique sound. And I mean, vocally as well, the band were quite kind of blessed vocally, weren't they? You know?
Well, yeah. And Nigel and Andy had good voices. I got away with it.
Yeah, but it kind of, you know, because even live, the vocals were strong. It wasn't like just a studio thing, was it?
This is it. I'm not a natural singer. I can sort of, I always needed help in the studio to, not with auto-tuning, but just with, this is the tune, this is the pitch you need to go. Yeah. I couldn't automatically pitch. I always need, this is the tune, this is the note you need to get to, and I need to do it a few times to get there. And it's a lot to do with confidence, you know, because I didn't feel like I had the struggle. But what I did do was choose the Graham Nash harmony, because we were really into Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nash always had the high harmony, because playing live, and I'm playing the drums, and I've got the microphone there, I can't do a middle harmony and try to expect to hear myself.
Sure, yeah.
But anyway, you know, it's just by chance, just by the way we were. I've got a high voice anyway, and so I can sing well. That's my natural voice. So I would get the high notes, and obviously you can hear the higher one a lot easier than the lower one. So that's how we harmonized. And I listened back, and I, at the time I was always not that very confident. Felt like I was letting the boys down. But as I listened back, it wasn't that bad. Mm. And certainly now we're a lot better. I'm a lot better.
Yeah.
And I'm a lot more confident singing and stuff. And the album that we did back in 2010, Stand Up Right in a Cool Place, there's a lot of harmonies on that.
Yeah.
And we toured that a few times. And touring that and knowing that I could hit, you know, blend and all that was good. You know, so yeah, the harmonies have always been a really important part of the band.
There's another Roger Taylor thing there. He always took care of the high stuff, didn't he? You know, people always thought it was Freddie doing the high stuff. Not necessarily.
No. I mean, he was great. He, you know, he did all the real
Rosetto
stuff, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Totally. But I mean, you've had amazing success with Dodgy. I remember you at 97 Glastonbury. But did you do one before or not? I can't remember.
We did one in 92.
Oh, did you?
Did one in 93, did one in 95.
Oh, blimey, okay.
In 97. And then we had Nigel left and we got a different singer and we did one in 99. And I played there with him and everything else that works. I played there with Electric Softblade. Maybe even played there with the Lightning Seeds. I don't know.
Really?
But I played last week quite
so
a few.
So he's home from home then?
Yeah, it's not like it was.
No,
not like it was. It was in the '90s, in the early '90s.
Yeah.
It was a different thing altogether.
Yeah. Well, I remember watching you on TV. I think it would have been in 97, and I remember thinking because I think it was an afternoon set. I can't remember.
We were on the pyramid. 97. We were on the pyramid stage around about 5 o'clock.
Because remember, it was still pretty light, and it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was. It was us, then it was Ocean Colour Scene, then it was Radiohead.
Oh, now that's a proper 90s lineup, that, isn't it, eh?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, you got fond memories of Glastonbury?
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
So many. I remember the first time I went, it was just that feeling of lawlessness.
Yeah.
You know, 150,000 people with no police.
Yeah.
And every junction you went to, there were drug dealers there. But everyone was really cool.
You know,
there was no kind of feeling of, you never felt threatened or anything. I'm sure loads of people got robbed.
Oh,
but there was that kind of excitement of like, this is fucking wild. I mean, the travellers were still coming in and it was still pretty crazy. And Channel 4 were doing the, I think Channel 4, it wasn't being broadcasted. You know, now, of course, every field has its own BBC channel.
Of course.
It's very middle class now, you know.
Yeah. So in 97, it hadn't started, it hadn't been broadcast. I seem to remember
95.
Right.
Channel 4 were broadcasting. They may have done it a few years before. Channel 4 were the station who were broadcasting Glastonbury.
Right, okay.
And we were on stage in 95, probably about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And they wanted us to be the first band to open the broadcasting of Channel 4.
Yeah.
Of Glastonbury, and they wanted it to be staying out for the summer.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went on stage and we had our manager say, look, I'll give you the countdown, and then bang, you're in.
Yeah.
And you've got to say, welcome Channel 4 to Glastonbury, staying out for the summer. And so we were playing and our manager says, all right, look, you've got literally 2 minutes. There's no point doing another song.
Yeah.
Play something until then. And so our keyboard player started Don't Stop Me Now.
Okay.
Like, we don't stop me now. We started doing that. The crowd, of course, we go bananas. Dang. And they went, oh, we've got to stop that now. We've got to stop that now. And then Nigel went, welcome, Glastonbury, Channel 4. Doo-doo-doo-doo. We started standing. So I know that Channel 4 did, and you can still see that footage on YouTube, and that's brilliant, just seeing the crowd.
That's amazing.
You know, I still see people nowadays who say, I was in that crowd, and I could see myself on the video. And, you know, so it was crazy times. But the first time I went, 92, James were on the James were headlining the Pyramid.
Yeah.
Tom Scream were headlining the Enemy.
Oh, amazing.
And that was Screamadelica. And it was, and the bands before it was Flowered Up, The Orb, Primal Scream. So there was a lot of very, very high people by the time Primal Scream got on stage.
That's, you know, it's, as you say, it's a different time for music now. Now you get people going on with no band.
In the Kanye West the Jay-Z versus Noel Gallagher,
yeah.
I'm with Jay-Z every time. I mean, how dare Noel Gallagher say that? That's not music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When it entertains lots of people.
It's changed, that's for sure. You know, I think Glastonbury's changed. It's had to go more commercial, hasn't it? And it has. It's got to survive. And
it's health and safety. They've had to introduce a lot of that.
Yeah.
They've had to do, of course, commercial with making sure it can survive. And have people having really good ideas, like having phone charging places and things like that. And also, you know, because at the end of the day, they want to be able to give loads of millions to charity.
Yeah.
So therefore, they're going to get sponsorship that way. And the BBC being involved, it's a big event now. You know, so I can understand.
Yeah.
Why it's gone the way it has gone, but I'll always remember those kind of lawless days.
I've been to one Glastonbury, and I can't remember when it was. It was a long time ago. I know Tom Jones did the legend spot, awful long time
ago. Yeah, I know. Yeah,
and
10 years ago, something
like that. Yeah, but I prefer to watch it on the telly, you know. I like like my own comforts and stuff. And you can pick and choose, watch what I want. But, you know, as a kid watching it and watching footage of it, you always think, what must it be like to go out on that pyramid stage to that size of crowd? I mean, the adrenaline rush must be incredible, right? Because I still don't know. I've never played to a crowd like that. How is it when you're in? You go on and you just walk out and it's there. Can you describe that even?
Well, you're thinking of fucking out some dodgy fans out there, you know?
Yeah, I suppose you've got to be in your mind.
You're hoping, you know, you want, because there'd be nothing worse than, you know, starting and none of them start bouncing, none of them start singing and start moving away, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're faced with a challenge,
yeah.
You know, with 60,000, certainly the Pyramid stage, 70,000 people more back then, God, more even, I don't know, just looking at you, looking at you, and you're like, and they're going, come on then. And they're willing you along, you know. And if you can just hit that, bam, we're getting there. As I said, like in 95 with the other stage, the enemy stage, and seeing it, and you know, yes, got it. And it is an old mythical idea of the transference of energy, and it's true. You know, it really is true. It's, you know, you've got that many people wanting to have a good time, and if the band on stage can give them that good time, and the band on stage actually give a shit, want it to happen, and then that transfers to them, and the band, the audience go, yes, we respond to that, and we're going to do this, and we're going to scream, and we're going to clap, and we're going to dance, and the band go, and we respond to that, we're going to give you more back, and that's that thing, and it's
like an energy spiral,
and I know what I'm like when I'm in a crowd with I saw Neil Young at Glastonbury 8 years ago, whatever, Bruce Springsteen, and I've been in the crowd, and I said I saw Primal Scream there back in 91, and just being like, and to me, it's never about the band. It's always about the audience. It's always about what are they saying, the laughs you can have, and the jokes, and what people are shouting, and then, you know, you're next to someone and they're going, oh, how are you doing? And you start hugging them and having a good time with them. And it's all about that. It's that community, which you can never get anywhere else, you know. And then they start playing a song that you both love and you both look at each other and you think, I've never met this person before, but you're both crying and it's one of you both singing. I mean, that is priceless, and that's human connection beyond anything ever. You know, and then that's wonderful. And if I can bring that to someone, amazing.
You've sold it, I tell you. You have. Sold. I'll buy it. I'll take it. Do you know, you've done a lot more aside from Dodgy. I mean, one of my favourite bands, The Lightning Seeds, and I know you've done, you know, quite a considerable amount with them as well, touring and what have you. I'm guessing... Was the connection with Ian Brody from the first album when he produced it for you? Is that where the connection came from?
Yeah. And he loved the way I played because he said I played like a Scouser.
I'll say that as a compliment, yeah.
Because Scousers have also playing, you know, you look at the band, don't you remember a band called The Stairs? Get on the wee bows, summertime. And a lot of bands, you know, you look at Keith and Cast. Yeah. And they just have that swing, you know. Sharrock being a typical example, well, probably the prime example.
Ainsley Dunbar.
Was he a Scouser?
He's a Scouser, yes, he is indeed.
Well, you know, so that swing, there's that shuffle that they do, and playing behind the beat, you know.
Yeah.
Simon Kirkup, who you said, three, he played behind the beat.
Yeah.
You know, not playing direct.
Yeah.
And Scousers have that. And Ian Brody thought I played like a Scouser. And during one of the first sessions we did in Liverpool with Ian Brody on the first album, he invited Ian McNabb down.
Yeah.
And he said, there's a guy here that can play a bit like Chris. And Ian was like, all right, I'll come down to him. And he was in the glass, beyond the glass, watching me. And I was banging away. Nowhere near as good as Chris, but he could see what I was doing. And of course, we bonded straight away. He goes, yeah, great. Chris would love you, mate. Let's go get pissed. So we went and got drunk, and we've been friends since then, you know. And I played with Ian Brody and the Lightning Seeds, and I played with Ian McNabb and the Oscar Works.
Yeah.
And what's fucking quite imposing with that was that both of them, the Lightning Seeds, had Chris Sharrock. And Zach Starkey, and the Oscar Works had Chris Sharrock and Zach Starkey.
It's crazy.
So I was kind of like, I would be third in line after those two, trying to do what they did. I could never play like Chris Sharrock and never play with Zach Starkey, but I did my thing,
that. When people say that, I always think, well, if they'd have wanted you to play like Chris Sharrock or play like Zach Starkey, they'd have probably just got Chris Sharrock or Zach Starkey, you know?
Well, there's a reason why, because Chris was doing other things and Zach was probably with The Who and whatever. It's
like, oh, well.
There's a reason why they didn't have him. Yeah. The reason why I was there, you know? But I did a good job of imitating, of getting the sound that Ian Brody wanted and what Ian McNabb wanted as well.
Yeah. I think the Lightning Seeds... I mean, I only know, I'm just trying to think. I think I only know Birds Fly by the Icicle Whiz. It's the only song I know, I think. The Big Tom Patton,
I
yeah.
mean, I thoroughly recommend the first album. I thoroughly recommend Get the Best Of. Or the
really?
First album is Cliché, but it's very, very 80s. Hugh Jones, who produced Dodgy, produced that first album. Right. It's very 80s production. Uh-huh. Big gated snares and lots of tom-toms. Burundi. But it's Sharrock, and you can hear Sharrock all over that. You know? It's incredible. He's 17. You know what I mean?
Is that all he was?
How good he was, Sharrock. You know, it's, you hear him on all different things, from The Lars to World Party, and just how delicate he can play, and just that swing.
Beautiful
and,
touch.
I remember we did a tour with him because he was also playing with a band called The Lemon Trees, which was Guy Chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supporting Dodgy on some days. And so Chris Sharrock was sort of supporting us, bizarrely. Mm. And he would always be in our dressing room. And you know, great to see him. So I'd be sort of behind him watching him play. And his kit was tiny. And I tried to sit behind it. And, you know, and it was there, and his tom-tom was there. And he played like Ringo. He had that kind of thing with the swing there. But he'd be like, and it's so, how did you play that? It's incredible. When you watch him play, it's just how quick he is.
Yeah, it's a hypnotic, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's just incredible. You know, he's one of my favourite drummers.
There's some great players around, and you know, and all these names you've mentioned are all very organic sounding drummers, Zach included, you know. They've got some.
Well, he's got to be good, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, with the Lightning Seeds, it's, you know, I was honoured to play when Ian asked me to play for him. And I think we had two or three rehearsals, and then my first ever gig was in Anfield, headlining the Hillsborough Justice campaign gig at Anfield, and that was my first ever gig with the Lightning Seeds.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely shitting myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're Martin, the bass player, is particularly supportive. Mm. And I said this the other day as well, is the Manics couldn't headline.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't be advertised because they were playing the festival down there.
Yeah.
And Sean and, sorry, Nicky and James from the Manics knew that it was my first gig. And they stood by the side of the stage for the whole gig. Just, come on, man.
Really?
Yeah. And I just thought, you know, well, we're not mates necessarily. I see them and I'm like, hey, them boys, you know, but it was just that camaraderie, that kind of, you know, socialism. But we'll help you. We'll help you get through this.
That's lovely.
You'll never walk alone.
Hey. Well, now we're talking. Do you know, I mean, for a gig like that, how do you go about, I mean, were you at that point able to read enough to put a cheat sheet down and what have you?
Oh, God, no.
No, so it was literally...
No. I did my own notes.
Yeah.
I did my own notes, which is, you know, guitar times four, guitar intro times four.
Yeah, yeah. Well, get you through
and
it.
And then I'll write stuff down that I recognise.
Hmm.
You know, like, if it's I did it the other day. I did a gig in Guernsey. Just for an old mate of mine, he had a covers band, and said, look, I'll pay for you to come over to Guernsey, let's put you in a nice hotel, and play my covers band. And I was like, yeah, come on, I'll do that. It's really that weekend. It was really good fun. And we did like 8 tunes, we did Born to Run. Fucking
hell. Oh, great. What a song to play.
What a song to play. But, you know, like Lovely Day, Bill Withers.
Yeah.
But one of the songs was Pretenders, Chain Gang.
Oh, great.
And it had a beat where it goes like this. And we do at the end of a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And in my language, in my drum language, that's called the I Will Follow beat by Larry Mullen. Because that's the I Will Follow. When I was first learning drums and me playing along to Larry Mullen by, you know, you too. So on my little crib sheet that I did by myself, I was like, yeah, I've done so many intros, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end of the album, I will follow. At the end of the,
yeah. But it works.
Because I know what that means. You know what I mean? I would look at that. I didn't even look at my notes. But it's nice to write them out. When you write out your own language.
They go in.
You write out your own drum music. That is part of the learning.
Yeah, they go in. They soak in, don't they? I mean, I remember doing a gig with like a folk/country band, and it was all covers, all originals. I didn't know, and I didn't have a metronome. So I listened to the tracks, and I remember writing for the tempo markings. There was one song about this beat, and I just wrote Ace of Spades at the side of it. And because I knew the tempo of Ace of Spades, and like, one, two. And just before going it, the guy had glanced over the set list, and he's very Welsh, and he went, dude, he says, there's been a bit of a mix up. He says, on the set list, he said, Ace of Spades, we're not doing it tonight like we do it normally, you know. And I know it's the, you know, it's just the tempo of the song. So I'd have like, pardon me, I'd have like songs like, I don't know, Hotel California, or I'd write just to give me an idea of the tempos. And
absolutely. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, you want it up there, don't you?
Yeah.
But also, if you do get that brain, oh my God, where am I? And you've got your notes next to you. You know, I did it with the lightning scene, did it with the Oscar words, I did it with the electropy, where you've got it there just in case.
Yeah.
And you can look at it just before a song and look at the danger zone and go, yeah, I know where that danger zone is and I know what I'm going to do at that point. There.
Yeah.
You know, and it's usually a page long, and I can show those notes to anyone and it would make no sense whatsoever. But it makes complete sense to me of where that means. And you know, and I'll come across a drum phrasing or something, I'll go, how am I going to explain that to me? And and unfortunately, sometimes I would have to do some kind of drum music to it.
Yeah.
You know, and write it down. But I'm not going to see that in the dark. You know what I mean? So I'll think of a song that it's similar to, just like you said. You know?
Yeah, but it was anything.
But we said, but Born to Run, wow, what a song to play to.
Superb. Great, great tune.
God, but just what a drummer. Fucking hell.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, what you know, because we were doing also Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty, and of course the mistake to make with covers is to listen to the original recording, because you're never going to get Baker Street. And of course, I found a live version of Baker Street because there's loads of percussion.
Yeah, of course there is.
Great song to play live. I would never know that, because when you're doing that big build of. And you've got that tom tom.
Yeah.
And I watched what the drummer was doing. Of course, he was just going, you know, fours on the click, you know, on the side stick. Yeah. Ah, fuck, that's easy. But watching what what's his face does for Springsteen, and watch what he does in Born to Run. Because you listen
Max Weinberg, isn't it? Yeah.
What is he doing there?
Yeah.
But you watch him, and there's a couple of really good recordings, videos live of him. And he's again just keeping it solid, you know.
Relentless.
No, I love it. But I love playing covers. I love it. Me and Andy from Dodgy, we had a Northern Soul band called the Soul Winners.
Okay.
And, we played around London a few times, and more than a few times. Did some weddings and whatnot, and did Friends and whatnot. And it was all Northern Soul stuff. Cool. And I love learning. You know, me and Andy both said, learning the tracks, learning the songs tells you so much.
Yeah.
You know, certainly a lot of the old soul songs, the old Motown songs.
Oh, it's just so much.
What did they do, and why were they so economical, and how did that, and why did that feel work there?
Yeah.
You know, and then you just bring it back into your own music. It's brilliant. Yeah,
incredible. So, you know, you've had an amazing career so far. You're still doing your teaching. You're still playing. I mean, Dodgy are still a thing, aren't they?
Yeah. We're playing on Friday.
Yeah.
I don't know when this goes out.
This will be out. This will be out the day after. This will be Saturday.
You played last night.
There you go. You did a gig last
night, London.
How did it go?
It was fucking shite. Awful. Awful. These kids lost the stage. And I had a bad boat, accidentally killed him. Oh, it was awful, man, you know. But no, we're playing July the 9th. We're playing Fee Fest, which is in Maidenhead. A couple have got cancelled, as they do, because it is still that climate, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, what's going on is that a lot of bands, a lot of festivals are going, right, brilliant, COVID's over, let's make some money. But of course, bang, now here comes the cost of living crisis. So a lot of people can't afford it. And quite rightly, you know, a lot of these bands, a lot of the festivals are charging a lot of money.
Yeah, of course.
And so we were aware of that, you know, and we've got some festivals this season and a few gigs maybe up until Christmas. Mm. Next year, we were going to be trying to do the anniversary of Three Piece Suite.
Oh, yeah.
Which was our biggest selling album.
Yeah, yeah.
On the 25th anniversary, which would have been last year. But we couldn't do that. So we're probably going to do the 28th anniversary.
It's not quite the same ring, but hey.
28. Important year, 28. You know that, mate. We might have done it this year, the 27th anniversary, and we could have hung it. But no, hang on. 25th anniversary was 2000. Yeah, next year's the 27th anniversary. What we're going to do, 27, really important age in rock and roll. Kurt Cobain died.
Yeah.
You know, they all died. Jimi Hendrix died. Janis Joplin died. Jimmy, Kurt, they all died 27. So we're going to call it 27, not out.
Like that.
27, not out. And so, yeah, so we think we'll do that. I think if I got the maths right, I should get it right because I'm a maths teacher, but it's 27, not out, three-piece suite next year.
Beautiful. Well, that'll be amazing. What a full tour to back it up and do the whole
thing. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's 14 songs on that one. So,
yeah.
Strings and girls and everything. So we might have to down a bit.
Leave the strings, bring the girls. Math, this has been a treat, mate. It really has. And I can't thank you enough for doing it, you know. Even without trousers, it's still been a privilege.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hope they got a thrill out of that. And C-3PO here, he hasn't said a lot, but I think he enjoyed it as well.
You know, great contributor, I have to say. So, look, honestly, mate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matty.
Wish you all the very best for the future. Hopefully catch you next year on the 27th anniversary.
27 not out. And good luck with everything with this podcast, mate.
Thank you, mate. I really appreciate it. Cheers, Matt.
Okay. See you.